It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We turn to your requests seeking a deeper dive on global events and specifically Russia's invasion of Ukraine, now entering a third year. Thanks to Jerry in Kakana asking for a discussion about military aid from allies. And Tomas in Madison wants
more about the kind of changing geopolitical landscape and the need for a multipolar world, and how the United States specifically should be positioning itself in order to avoid getting sucked into World War III.
Colin with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So let's start with Ukrainian forces retreating from the eastern city of Avdiivka, and getting reports here the broader war has essentially been a stalemate. What is the significance of Ukraine retreating from a city?
Well, it's hard to assess the significance. I'll tell you, there's sort of two perspectives on this. One is that it's actually unfortunate or quite detrimental to the Ukrainian cause, because the Ukrainians now face the major crisis they face, in addition to some political crises, is shortage of manpower and ammunition. And the fear is that this victory that the Russians have in Avdiivka will be followed up with a continuing advance, and that it will really hurt Ukrainian morale. And it will be very difficult for the Ukrainians to continue to hold out against further advances. So that's sort of the skeptical, very dire assessment. On the other hand, there are other well-informed analysts who argue that Avdiivka is not really a big deal. Strategically, it doesn't really represent a major asset to the Russians, that the Russians themselves are likely to be exhausted. They lost a mass number of casualties, massive amount of equipment. And so, the more the less pessimistic, shall we say, assessment is that Avdiivka will not lead to further advances, but rather the Ukrainians will successfully dig in. A lot of it turns on, honestly, in my opinion, whether or not the American aid comes through that is currently still up in the air as a result of the House of Representatives failing to vote on it.
Yes, House Speaker Mike Johnson has yet to bring up the $95 billion package that would deliver military aid to Ukraine and Israel. So where does the Wisconsin House Conference stand on the bill, and where are the roadblocks right now?
Well, I think the Wisconsin House Conference is divided along, so far as we know, divided along party lines, although Representative Gallagher has stood out, who's recently announced he's not going to run for re-election. But he's also stood out as somebody who's been quite tough on Russia, sort of. I imagine if it does come up to a vote, Gallagher will probably vote yes. I don't, that's based on my assessment of his past practices. I agree with the many analysts who argue that if it is actually put to a floor vote, it will pass, and it will probably pass rather convincingly. I think the Democratic caucus is unified more or less in support of the package. There may be a few defectors because it includes aid to Israel as well. But the Republicans are fairly divided. The real issue is that the Speaker has refused so far to put the measure up for a vote. And there are various parliamentary techniques, discharge petition and so forth, that the Democrats and the Republican sympathizers with the bill may use. I think there's tremendous public pressure right now on the Speaker to bring this to a vote, and as there should be. I think the murder of Navalny by the Putin regime, Alexei Navalny, the long-term oppositionist in Russia, I think that only furthers the amount of pressure that Johnson is facing to step up to the plate and have an actual floor vote on this bill.
Ted Gerber with us, UW Madison sociology professor focusing on Ukraine as we talk about the Russia-Ukraine war. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, let's turn to Navalny's legacy as we saw the opposition leader Alexei Navalny dying in a Russian prison camp. What is Navalny's legacy?
Well, I mean, I think it is Navalny's legacy is to provide inspiration and hope to the many Russians who envision a different Russia than they've been offered under the Putin regime. The amount of courage he displayed, in fact, I think was one of the factors that actually got him ultimately killed. I think, you know, it's hard to think in world history of similar leaders, and by leaders, I don't necessarily mean leaders of countries, but leaders of movements, people who inspire others. And the fact that he returned to Russia, having already been almost poisoned to death, poisoned nearly to death, knowing full well what was going to happen to him, but nonetheless being committed to his cause and his purpose, which is a noble one, I think it really does inspire people worldwide. You see the reaction of world leaders. You see the reaction of Russians themselves, who those in the opposition in particular, who've had very little to cheer about. And so, of course, his death is tragic and sad. Of course, it's also been widely expected. And I think it makes people angry at this regime and what Putin stands for, which is murderous sort of revenge on anyone who dares to stand up to Putin's authority. And so I'm very optimistic that actually his death will inspire people to work harder, to fight harder, to continue to work for a better future for Russia than what Putin offers them.
But is there any way for the West to truly assess Putin's grip on power and the strength of the opposition who want that democratic future in that part of the world? How can you measure that?
You know, it's very difficult to measure. And there's actually, I would say, on the one hand, there's the conventional wisdom among that you read a lot about in the Western media coverage, which says that Putin is very strong, that he's been able to oppress most of the opposition, and that the war on Ukraine has helped him in that effort. It certainly seems, you know, by any objective measure, most of the opposition are really, even before the war, you know, there had been an effort. But since the war began, or since the full-scale invasion, I should say, began, Putin has really ramped up the crackdown. The opposition is weak. He seems to have he managed to deal with some internal dissent in the form of Prigozhin's mutiny. You know, Prigozhin, his erstwhile friend and a successful leader of the Wagner group of militants, carried out a mutinous march on Moscow, as it were, last summer in June. And Putin seemed to have dealt with that pretty well. So the conventional wisdom is he's in great shape. You know, the U.S., the West seems on their heels. Ukraine seems to be in retreat. But another perspective is that actually this is a very thin veneer that Putin has been, although he projects a sense of power, we don't really know what the vast majority of Russians think. And, you know, historically, we've seen in many authoritarian regimes, there appears to be a broad public support or at least acquiescence to the authoritarian system. But very suddenly that can turn. So, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, up until the very last moment, nobody could possibly imagine it would collapse. And yet then when it collapsed, everybody produced analyses showing that its collapse was inevitable. We could be looking at the same situation in Russia, and we just don't know. I don't believe the opinion surveys that are conducted in Russia. If you look at some other indicators, Russia's not doing so well. It's lost a lot of human capital. Its economy has managed to weather the storm of the sanctions, but it has aspects that suggest it's going to be completely unsustainable. So, for example, you know, imports of high-tech goods are way down, and they can put bandages on broken oil pipes and things like that for a while, but there's a cumulative effect of that lack of access to technology that are really going to hinder the Russian economy moving forward. So I think personally, actually, Putin is not in his in such great a position as many observers seem to think he is.
That analysis by UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber with us, who directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project, as we discuss world alliances and Russia's war against Ukraine. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the trajectory of the Russia-Ukraine war entering a third year and what this conflict means to Americans and Wisconsinites who are thousands of miles from Kyiv. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Just wanted to relay two very interesting conversations I had recently, one with a former Romanian citizen, one with, I think it was a dual citizenship Russian from Moscow, and neither one knew each other. But what was so interesting was how their perspectives were very similar in that these Eastern Bloc countries, Russia, really suffered after the ending of the Cold War. What happened, apparently, is that all these factories, businesses were kind of turned over to an elite group of oligarchs, whatever you want to call them. And it was kind of a free-for-all for these people to basically take over all the resources of the country. The people suffered, and they kind of longed for what was formerly communism, authoritarian rule, and that's what they feel Putin is bringing back, and that's why I think Putin is maybe in a stronger position than what people realize. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Ted, go ahead.
Well, yes, I mean that is certainly true that many Russians, as well as citizens of other countries in the former Soviet bloc, suffered economically in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the similar regimes which the Soviet Union backed in Eastern Europe. And it's also true that the politicians like Putin have made a career out of playing upon the sort of lingering economic resentment, the nostalgia for the good old days where things seem secure. However, you know, reality is, of course, much more complicated. And a lot of that kind of perspective that first of all, it's one-sided. There are many people who did benefit from the changes following the Soviet collapse. There was very uneven the sorts of economic problems. And most countries of Eastern Europe, such as Poland, the Czech Republic, the Baltic Republics, they actually have thriving economies. So they experienced a period of crisis in the 90s, but since then they've been really taking off. Russia has been somewhat exceptional in this regard. Russia did have a decade of economic growth. It was very impressive in the 2000s when Putin first came to office, and it was driven largely by the export of oil and natural gas, which continues to be the major source of economic growth and performance in Russia. However, arguably, it was the Putin regime's own tendency to abscond with large sums of the wealth that was generated by Russia's exports that is to blame for the fact that many Russians still live in a relatively impoverished state, that the average earnings in Russia, people should know, are somewhere between $600 a month. Hmm. And so, that's obviously, imagine trying to get by on $600 a month. Perhaps some of your listeners do, but it's very difficult. And so Russia is not a thriving society, and Putin blames the collapse of the Soviet Union, where, in fact, Putin's policies themselves have contributed tremendously, probably the single most important factor, to the fact that Russia's economy is not thriving. And yet, so one way to understand this war that he's launched against Ukraine is that, in fact, it serves to distract his population from the fact that it's his government policies that are largely responsible for the failure of Russian standards of living to improve. Instead, he blames some kind of mysterious conspiracy in the West and launches a war in order to justify his arguments along these lines.
I want to ask, though, if Russia's economy continues to stagnate or cannot adapt, cannot move away from fossil fuels as the world tries to do so, will Putin be able to finance his war, or will he have to rely more and more on other authoritarian regimes in the world?
Well, I think the latter is the case. I don't think he will be able to continue to finance the war. I think, and so of course, he's not going to say that. Of course, the Russians argue, look, we are strong. We have all these resources. We have a strong ally in China. We have strong allies in countries like North Korea, Iran, Venezuela. I mean, if you're looking for a sort of cabal of international pariah states from the perspective of the West, Putin also argues they have allies in the so-called global South. The countries in, developing countries, rising powers like South Africa have been quite sympathetic with Putin. But you're absolutely right that the internal dynamics of the Russian economy are very unfavorable. In the long run, wars and military technology and military power is based on economic power. You need money to produce weapons, to innovate, to come up with technological improvements. One thing the war showed us is that Russia has really not modernized its military quite as effectively, or not nearly as effectively, as they've claimed to have done in recent years. The weaponry competition really favors the Western weapons. When the Ukrainians have been armed, they've been quite effective at throwing back the Russia assault. They've been quite innovative. We don't see that kind of spark coming out of Russia. And in fact, if anything, the war is going to make it even harder. When they're losing their human capital, the young people with high levels of education have been leaving Russia in droves. The long-term and even the medium-term economic future of Russia looks quite grim. And so it really will turn on whether the West is able to maintain its solidarity and to keep up its support of Ukraine. And if it does, I think most likely, no one can really predict the future, but I think most likely Russia will be ground down and will not be able to sustain this war effort for the years that it seems to envision, or at least want us to think it's willing to do. So I think you're absolutely right that the economic situation in Russia is going to make it hard for it to continue its current policies, so long as it is not victorious. Now, if Russia wins the war, that will change the dynamic and it'll allow Russia the chance to retool, to step back, to consolidate its gains, and then to press further, which I think it probably will if it does win this war.
Talking with Ted Gerber, UW-Madison sociology professor, who focuses on Ukraine as we discuss the Russia-Ukraine war entering a third year. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Turning to Ukrainians, how is this prolonged war affecting Ukrainian citizens?
Well, it's been quite devastating and extremely painful. So Ukraine has lost huge swaths of its territory. It's lost a major chunk of its population, both population that lives. There's estimated some 5 million Ukrainians living in the territories currently occupied by Russia. There's another 5 million Ukrainians who have been deported or voluntarily left those territories for Russia. There's probably some 7 to 8 million Ukrainians who have left Ukraine and fled as refugees to Europe. Right now, I think the Ukrainians have been displayed remarkable resilience, remarkable strength, remarkable national unity up to this point. But there are signs that may be starting to crack. I mean, any people who has to endure what Ukraine has in the last 2 years, these, constant bombardments from Russian missiles and drones, many of them supplied by Iran, on civilian targets, the loss of their husbands, fathers, sons at the front, the economic devastation wrought by the nature of war. We are starting to see signs of dissent within Ukraine. That Ukraine's one of its big problems now is a shortage of manpower for the front. It's having a lot of trouble figuring out ways to mobilize more men to go and serve in the military. I think right now morale is probably pretty low in Russia. We've seen the removal of the commander of the Ukrainian armed forces recently by the president. There's discussions within Ukraine itself. There are increasingly grumblings about the policies of President Zelensky. I think the situation is indeed pretty dire.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us and for the update.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a development plan for Minneapolis and what Wisconsin communities could take away from this blueprint for sustainable growth and change. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's former executive producer Erica Janik with a story about a civil rights icon who lives here in Wisconsin.
Gwen Gillen now calls Madison home, but her roots are in the South, where she fought for civil rights. Jeff Burkhart brings us her story.
Civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael called her a gutsy little sister. At 17, Gwen Gillen became the youngest staff member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, the retired teacher calls Madison home, but she grew up in Anniston, Alabama, one of seven children.
My first memory is that three-room shack, and oftentimes when you see old movies of the South and the slave huts, you see these three-room shacks where we didn't have electricity, we had candle lights at night, and there was no refrigerator, and the ice man used to come around. So we pretty much had the same meal every day until I graduated. From high school, we had beans and cornbread.
Later, they moved to Bear Mash at the foot of the Appalachians, where they picked plums and blueberries, and they had electricity and running water. Gwen's mother was one of the people who petitioned the local government for it.
She worked as a maid, but she insisted that we go to school every day. You couldn't make the law see. She wanted a B or an A. During my senior year, I got chosen for a scholarship to go to Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi.
It was there at Tougaloo College in 1963 that she met members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
When I got to Tougaloo, I met the civil rights people, and I asked them, well, how can I be a part of the movement? And they said, well, you can join us. And so I dropped out of Tougaloo College in about 2 weeks after being there and joined the civil rights movement and became a staff member of SNCC.
Gwen later went to Oberlin College in preparation for the Freedom Summer of 1964.
We weren't making any progress, so to speak, just sitting in at lunch counters and stuff like that. So we thought the best thing to do was to register people to vote.
On the first day of Freedom Summer, June 21st, 1964, three young civil rights workers were murdered. They, like Gwen, had been registering black voters in Mississippi. The men were arrested by the police on trumped-up charges and then released after dark into the hands of the Ku Klux Klan.
We went hunting for them in the Neshoba County, and we would go in at night in black clothing and walk around the bushes and stuff and see if we could find them. I think they found them about a week or two later. It was frightening, but we had to do something.
Gwen continued to work for SNCC for the next 2 years. Then in 1966, she was offered a scholarship to the UW-Madison.
And I personally wanted to understand American history. I was a person and an American, and I didn't feel I should be treated any different than anybody else. And I just couldn't understand why they did that.
She studied American history, as she planned, and eventually got a degree in special education. She continued to be active in the civil rights movement on campus and in Milwaukee. Gwen's time fighting for civil rights in Alabama, Mississippi, and Wisconsin helped her understand herself and the importance of political participation.
I learned that you should vote every time. I think that voting matters.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a comprehensive citywide development plan in Minneapolis known as the 2040 Plan and ideas about land use changes that Wisconsin communities could consider to address housing affordability and equity. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bill Lindeke is a lecturer at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches classes on planning, Twin Cities geography, transit suburbia, and municipal financing. Writes the Cityscape opinion column for MinPost, the nonprofit news organization. Bill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So Minneapolis approves this 2040 plan about 5 years ago. And, you know, the city and the plan, they're praised for creating this innovative approach to zoning and development. What is unique about the plan? What stands out?
Well, it was pretty ambitious. It's part of this thing we have in the Twin Cities, a regional government called the Metropolitan Council, and requires every city to update their plan once every 10 years. So this wasn't something that was out of the blue. They have to do it every 10 years by law here in the Twin Cities, just like all 100 plus municipalities do. But in the 2040 plan, city leaders decided that they were going to be more ambitious. So they did a few things that caught the attention of a lot of people with their 10-year update. And that was eliminating single-family restrictive zoning in the city. Most cities in the country have whole big areas of their city where you can only build a single-family house. And that's one of the things they got rid of in Minneapolis as part of this process. The other things they did are kind of smaller and weren't in the headlines as much, but things like eliminating parking requirements, the idea that you have to build a off-street parking lot when you build a restaurant or an apartment building, or other things like upzoning along places that have transit access, so allowing new construction to have taller buildings. And so Minneapolis did that systematically as part of this 10-year update, and it really changed the zoning map for the city.
So, you know, Wisconsin is also grappling with housing, a housing shortage. What is problematic about single-family zoning?
Well, it's very exclusive, so it increases the costs of housing for people and reduces the kind of choices people have. I mean, there are big trends in our society. People are having fewer children. There are more single people. There's more older adults. You need a more wider diversity of housing types. The other big trend is, of course, as you know, rising housing costs all across the country in Wisconsin and Minneapolis. And so if you can figure out a way to build housing more affordably and having a duplex or a triplex or a small apartment building, that's a great way to do it. Because you have a lot of efficiency with the construction costs. So all those things were goals of the plan.
You have such a close eye on how Minneapolis is changing, how it looks now. I mean, I'm a Minneapolis native, and every time I go back, I sometimes can't even recognize where I came from. How drastically is the 2040 plan altering single-family neighborhoods?
Well, not very drastically is the answer. When this was being debated and passed in 2019, and it passed with a 12-1 vote at the city council, it received wide support from our elected officials. There were signs in people's yards saying, "Don't bulldoze our neighborhoods." But now, a few years later, the single family housing and the duplex changes hasn't led to big differences. There have been 72 new duplexes and 37 triplexes with three units in them in 2.5 years with the 2040 plan in place. The big difference has been sort of apartment buildings being built with less parking along these transit corridors, especially in places near, for example, downtown Minneapolis or near the University of Minnesota where I teach. So that's probably those neighborhoods where you don't really recognize what it used to look like.
Can the city take down existing homes through this plan?
No, that's also a misconception. So no one's going to come bulldoze your house unless you sell it to somebody, and then they might. But there's no eminent domain power involved here. It's just a zoning change.
It's just a zoning change. So, you know, how much community engagement has there been, I wonder, in the more recent years of this plan rolling out? I mean, how much has this been fueled by community discussions?
Well, the city spent a lot of time, years actually, talking to people. The first step they did was to, in 2016, go to the city council and have them identify 14 goals or values that would drive the change. And they adopted that in 2016. And the first goal was to eliminate disparities. Minneapolis, like Milwaukee, are places that have very wide gaps in home ownership between white families and Black families. It's about 75%. Home ownership rate for white people in the Twin Cities area and less than 25% for Black families. And that gap is the highest in the country. So that's something that nobody here is proud of and really wanted to change with this plan. So that was the first step of engagement. And then there were hundreds of small scale or large scale public meetings. The hearing at the city council was over 5 hours long, and I've watched all of it, and it was a very contentious debate. But when you got down to it back in 2019, it was a pretty overwhelming vote to support this zoning change.
Has this plan been able to hold down the cost of housing? Has it been able to hold down the rise in cost of rent, for instance?
Well, that's the key question, isn't it? But it's really hard to study that because there's so many variables that go into the housing market. The Pew Charitable Trust just came out with a report about how it has actually kept rents from rising in Minneapolis, the city. They increased housing stocks, the amount of homes, by 12% in a five-year period from 2017 to 22, and rents only went up 1% during that time, which is way below the national average and the Minnesota state average. But on the other hand, 2040 was only in place for a few of those years, and there's a lot of variables that went into that. For example, COVID is a huge unknown factor.
Bill Lindeke is an urban studies lecturer at the University of Minnesota. As we discuss city planning and zoning, you can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Minneapolis 2040 plan is a blueprint to shape how the city to our west will grow and change in years to come. And through this plan, Minneapolis was lauded as the first large city nationwide to eliminate single-family zoning. But the plan faces a legal challenge, which we'll talk about. Be part of the discussion. Call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Bill Lindeke, who is an urban geographer at University of Minnesota. So, Bill, several groups sued the city after the 2040 plan went into effect, and then a judge invalidated the plan. What arguments are opponents making against this plan?
Well, it was a case where the judge, the Minneapolis city attorney, tried to get it thrown out on a technicality. It's unusual for a comprehensive plan, which happen every 10 years. There's hundreds of them all around the state to be challenged. But there's a piece of legislation in Minnesota called the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act that's been around for over 50 years, and it's designed to prevent pollution and disturbance of environmental sustainable places. And so it's never been used to challenge zoning changes before. And that's what happened in this case. There was a group, one of them was called the Citizens Concern for Migratory Birds. They actually popped up when the Viking Stadium was constructed because they didn't use bird safe glass when they were constructing the large facade of the stadium. Mm-hmm. And another group that I don't think is very legitimate that came in and challenged the comprehensive plan on environmental grounds. So that hadn't been done, and it turned out that no one knew what would happen. And so this judge ruled in favor of the people, the environmentalists in this case, to stop the plan from taking place.
But does this action of striking down this plan help to create more policy awareness around environmental concerns?
Well, lots of environmental groups were supportive of the 2040 plan for lots of good reasons, in my opinion. There's increasing density in Minneapolis is good for climate change and climate action, reducing our carbon footprints, getting more people able to ride transit or walk to a store or to school or to work. These are the kinds of the goals that we need to be doing in the Twin Cities and around the country to take action on climate change, for example. So most environmental groups in the Twin Cities were supportive, but then this lawsuit is around. And what happened was the judge in this district court here put the plan on hold. So for the last year or so, people who are trying to build housing in Minneapolis have to use the old map instead of the one that was passed in 2019. And that has put a lot of projects in limbo.
Should a city's long-range development plans be considered sustainable at the outset as a given without, you know, further independent environmental review, do you think?
Well, that is a great question. But I think in general, the kinds of laws that we have on the books to deal with pollution should not really be applied to city zoning, which is a much more mundane everyday activity. And people are not pollution. People live in homes. In California, for example, there's a similar law called CEQA that has been used to stop things like enrollment at the University of California. What they did there is to make it so that zoning and other kinds of things are exempt from these environmental review processes, because the housing crisis in California is much worse than it is in Minneapolis. And there's currently legislation in Minnesota at the Capitol right now to try to make comprehensive plan changes immune to this environmental review. But that doesn't help Minneapolis in 2024, because they're still dealing with this lawsuit.
So Minneapolis is facing challenges, just like cities here in Wisconsin and around the country, as you mentioned, a lack of housing, inequality, homelessness, the consequences of climate change. Would the 2040 plan make progress in dealing with these issues?
I think it would. I think it has already. A good example, too, in St. Paul, where I live, they have passed a similar version of this. So we got rid of single family zoning in St. Paul. We didn't get as much attention for it, but that's fine.
That's how it goes in St. Paul.
It is. So I think it's really important for cities to be taking these kinds of actions to reduce the cost of housing and try to make some progress on these really important issues that you mentioned. Homelessness and housing costs are such a burden for most Americans.
What is your advice to communities that want to write their own, you know, development plans, their own 2045 plans, their own long-range planning? Is there something you can say about what has happened with the 2040 plan that could help us here in Wisconsin as we look to these long-range plans?
Well, I think framing things so that we are aware of how restrictive our rules are around zoning in our cities. Most places in Madison and Milwaukee, you can only build a certain kind of housing, and we need to be more flexible about how we live. And so that's a big goal. I think the other thing is to look at state policies, statewide policies around stuff like parking requirements. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me if you have a new restaurant in your neighborhood that they have to buy a house and tear it down and make a surface parking lot next to it. Just as a matter of course. And most cities in the country have rules about things like that. If we want to take climate action and reduce the cost of housing, we need to look at these rules that have been on the books for 100 years that aren't doing anyone any good.
We're talking about housing development and zoning plans. Bill Lindeke teaches planning and Twin Cities geography, transit, suburbia, municipal financing at the University of Minnesota. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. So, Bill, how could the fate of the 2040 plan affect what cities, you know, in other parts of the country and in Wisconsin do to address these problems?
Well, I think Minneapolis did a really excellent job with this plan, despite the outcome at the moment, because they captured a lot of attention and raised this awareness about things like single-family restrictive zoning, so that it allowed cities like St. Paul, like I said, to come in and kind of do the same thing with a lot less scrutiny and a lot less legal challenges. And so I think that's the model. I think we need to see other cities in Wisconsin, all around the country, to start following Minneapolis's path. And I think it'll help reduce housing costs. I think it'll help us come together around climate action to make it possible to have more sustainable choices in your daily life. The other thing that the plan did was to change some of the zoning rules so that you could have a corner store closer to your house, for example. There's a movement all around the country to kind of see these changes being done statewide. So I'll be really curious to see how the Wisconsin legislature maybe starts to look at some statewide zoning reforms that could happen in the future.
How much of this plan do you think is about less land consumption per person at the end of the day?
In a city like the Twin Cities, you have this trade-off because we're growing and there's people who want to move here. There's a huge labor shortage, and so we need more housing for people. And so where is that housing going to be built?
Mm-hmm.
It could be built way out at the edge of town, mm-hmm. where everybody has to drive everywhere, or you could build some right in the middle of Minneapolis or St. Paul, right next to a light rail line, for example, where you just have a lot more choices and flexibility about how you get around and whether you can go to a restaurant a block away, things like that. And so the more we can increase the choices for people and allow them to make decisions about how to live, I think that's the goal for cities in the future.
72 new duplexes. Do you see, aside from the litigation here, and we only have a few seconds, but do you see additional multiplex housing coming onto the cityscape in Minneapolis?
Well, yeah, those duplexes are just the ones in the single family zoning change.
Okay.
There's been a lot of apartment construction. So mm-hmm. they added over 10% to the housing stock in a 5-year period. And so that's really been the one that's making the difference. The duplexes are nice, though, too, because it increases density in a smaller scale way that people are more comfortable with in your neighborhood. I live next to a duplex. I'm staring at it out my window right now, and it's fine.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Bill Lindeke is a lecturer at the University of Minnesota, writes the Cityscape Opinion column for MinPost, a nonprofit news organization. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a color-only program, and thanks to our producers, we have hundreds of guests each year who bring their knowledge and their experience to share with Wisconsin and beyond. And so we want to know, who do you want to hear from? What are your ideas for future segments? What themes and issues are a priority for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Sean in Oshkosh. Sean, what's on your mind?
Yes, hello, good morning. Thank you for taking the phone call. I would really like it if you would do an in-depth expose, pro and con, extremely thorough. Why is video gambling allowed in the state of Wisconsin? It's in every gas station. It's in every bar. Gambling is extremely addictive. Unfortunately, I've had gambling addiction affect my life through other members of the extended family. Where does the money go? What's being done? I see homeless people in front of Quick Trip panhandling, and then I see them at another gas station gambling. I see people with disabilities in the gas station, in the bars, gambling. We're getting stuck with the taxpayer money, and why is gambling legal, which is extremely addictive and has been well documented, but marijuana is not?
Sean, thank you so much for bringing this to the table. As you say, let's look much more deeply about video gambling machines at establishments in Wisconsin and where the funds go, and also the social implications of gambling. Appreciate the call. Let's bring in Brad in Sun Prairie. Brad, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So I think it's important that we talk more about international law and war crimes and human rights, because I think we need to protect human rights better and enforce the laws. Maybe we could organize to figure out how we could do that.
Is there a particular part of the world that you focus on?
Well, I mean, if we look back to World War II, the United States has violated the Geneva Conventions and the UN Charter at least 80 times, trying to overthrow other governments to steal their resources. And the U.S. is always above the law. There's plenty of other violations by Russia or China or whatnot, but I think we need to have everybody held accountable to law.
Brad, thank you for that suggestion. Wanting to hear much more about international law, war crimes, and human rights across the world, what can be done to improve it? And we are dedicating this program to you. What you want to bring to the morning show, we're taking down your ideas like Brad in Sun Prairies. This is Ideas Rich, and maybe you have a question you want to explore or stories or experiences you wish to share with fellow Wisconsinites. Call in with your show ideas now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Tom in Whitewater. Tom, what is on your mind?
I really wish you would do some segments on the subject of medical malpractice. Wisconsin has a full-fledged medical malpractice crisis, and the news media here simply does not talk about it.
And can you talk a little bit further about what is going on, what you see are the implications in medical malpractice?
In the state of Wisconsin, the laws here have been rolled back over the last 40 years to the point where it is basically impossible to sue a doctor or a hospital under any circumstance. And the result is we now have lots of doctors who are repeat offenders, and they are never held accountable. In my case, I was nearly killed by a chiropractor. I was misdiagnosed twice at an emergency room over a period of 2 days, and I nearly died from a massive traumatic brain injury. And today, I'm still fighting for my survival. We never got a settlement. And when we were fighting for a settlement, we learned that the doctor who misdiagnosed me at the ER had actually killed a student right in my hometown, and it wasn't his first victim, and he never was held accountable. And the Milwaukee Journal, the Wisconsin State Journal, did exposés over the last 3 years chronicling the trend of repeat offender doctors who have these egregious records of medical malpractice, and they can't be held accountable because the laws here are so turned upside down now. And families who are victims are left economically ruined and just fighting to survive.
Tom, thank you for sharing such a personal story. Wanting to see a much more in-depth and broader implications of medical malpractice and the specific patients as well and their stories. Thank you so much for calling in. Tim now in Hollandale is next. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think you should have a show on corporatism in America and just how bad it affects everybody.
And
you know, we don't Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Do you say like corporate interests, corporate profits? What do you see?
Just how corporations in America, you know, how they pollute, how they adjust prices, how it affects the average everyday American, how they're in the back pockets of the politicians, how they write a lot of the laws we have to deal with. You know, I don't think people really realize just how much power these people have and what they do and how much we share its ill effects. Especially, you know, people that go over to Europe understand that because they can see American-based food products. You read a label, the ingredients label. Their ingredients label is not like our ingredients label. You know, it's just there's a lot of stuff going on that Americans just aren't aware of.
Has corporate power and corporate interests influenced your livelihood and your way of life?
Well, it kind of has for everybody, mm-hmm. down to the food, the basic food groups that we grew up looking at school. These are the food groups you need to eat. Well, you know, that wasn't really true. That was all put forth by industries to promote their products. So, and that's true of most things we ingest, the pills we ingest, you know, right down the way, you know, adjusting of prices, the sugar industry.
So, yes, you know, see a much larger conversation about the influences and the ripple effects of corporate America. Tim, thank you so much for the call and appreciate you joining in. John from Madison called and says the morning show should focus programs on bridging the gap between the left and the right, finding that middle ground. John said talking about subjects that everyone can relate to, like universal health, would do that. John, thank you so much. And let's go to Jack now in Madison. Jack, what would you like to bring up?
You know, Kate, when we're talking about, you know, bridging gaps between people and places and communities, this is kind of a left turn, if you will, but I'm really big into transit, especially passenger rail. And I think it would be cool if WPR were to do more segments on transit and trains, and especially with the influx of money coming from the Biden administration and cities like Madison, Eau Claire, and Green Bay and more getting, you know, money and conducting studies for passenger rail. I think it would be great to do more segments on that and how that will better connect communities throughout our state and the nation at large.
Jack, would you take passenger rail more often if it was more accessible to you?
Absolutely, hands down.
And so you really want to see that expansion to happen in Wisconsin and particularly connecting communities in Wisconsin.
That's correct, Kate.
All right.
It would just be...
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
No worries. I was just going to say it would just be really cool because think about all the people who can go to Packer games and the EAA Air Venture up in Oshkosh and the Berkey and so many other, you know, fun events, you know, Summerfest. Like just it be just that much better for connecting people in our state and different like events that really make, you know, Wisconsin what it is.
Yes, you see the connectivity in that mode of transportation. Jack, thank you so much as we explore that angle of conversations and developments and stay on top of passenger rail. We are opening up the lines to you to find out where you want to take the show next. And let's talk about the programming you want to hear this month and into the future. The number is 800-642-1234. Join in on what questions you want us to explore, the kind of programming that would help your family's well-being. Be part of the caller only, 800-642-1234, email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is a caller-only program. It's dedicated to you and what you want to bring to these Wisconsin conversations. We're exploring your ideas for future programs and segments, and we're taking notes. Email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring in Roberto in Hilbert. Roberto, hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Kate. First, thank you for your show. We do appreciate all the stuff you guys bring up there.
Thank you.
My subject today is about how heavy racism is in the United States. And I'm hoping that you guys could bring someone, like a historian, to the show in the future so he can talk about the percentage of the United States that used to be Mexico. Like, I believe it's about 45%. Like San Antonio, you know what I mean? It's San Antonio. It's not San Antonio.
Mm.
California, it's California. You know what I mean? Before they really put the racism in front, we should all think about what used to belong to Mexico and think about everybody trying to live together, you know what I mean? Instead of saying, hey, go back to your country. Well, I am in my country because if I'm in Texas, it's just Mexico.
Roberto, appreciate you calling in and really wants to further understand that history with Mexico and also the racism that exists today with immigrants and migrant workers who come to Wisconsin and go elsewhere as well for work. Roberto, thank you so much for calling in, seeking a historian to talk further on that topic. Ron now in Manitowoc is here. Ron, hi.
Good morning. Thank you. Kate, how about a program on the high cost of the use of alcohol in Wisconsin and the refusal of the overpaid, underachieving politicians in Madison to raise the taxes, therefore putting the burden on the general taxpayer for the use of this beverage? Recently, the Valley's Journal had an article which indicated that Wisconsin has 41 of the top 50 drunkenness counties in the nation. Hmm. We should all be outraged on that figure. Thank you.
Ron, thank you. The negative effects, the economic, the health effects of alcohol in Wisconsin. Ron, bringing that issue to the table. Mark now in Elkhorn is here. Mark, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thanks for the show. Thanks for all the great callers in today. I just wanted to comment on the practice of garbage feeding. There's a lot of farms out there that are feeding their hogs and their livestock actual trash. And you can actually see the TikTok exposed video on YouTube called Garbage Feeding Exposed. And literally they're taking waste products and grinding them up into hog feed. And this is, you know, being fed to the animals. That's all I got. Thank you for taking my call.
Mark, thank you for bringing that up. The revelations there about garbage feeding on farms for farm animals, certainly appreciate that, as we certainly talk about agriculture on this program and elsewhere. Call in with your ideas for future programs. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Vern in Eau Claire called and has a few program suggestions. One is about growing corn to produce alcohol. Vern says this uses a lot of energy and would also like to hear about air travel. It is a huge driver of pollution. Vern also wants to have much more conversation about global warming. Thank you for joining in on that. Let's bring in Sam now in Wausau. Sam, what would you like to raise?
I want to raise awareness about homelessness and the substance abuse issues that are going on in the state. It's just a really big problem that people are getting undiagnosed with their mental issues and mental problems and thus going to self-soothe through substance abuse. And it's so easy for them to get access to these drugs and to these different substances, but it's not available for them to get access to treatment that works and treatment for housing and treatment for the programs that put them back to the end.
Oh, Sam, you're breaking up, but I think we have got that down. The the issues around homelessness that are connected to substance use and untreated mental health issues. Sam, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing that. And certainly we have had done a homelessness series and looked at a lot of these major issues around homelessness in Wisconsin, and we continue to follow those developments and where we go next on this issue. Madeline in Green Bay is here. Madeline, hi.
Yeah, I wish you would interview Dr. Ollie Reese. He was on the 60 Minutes show in January. He did pioneering research. He works at the Rockefeller Neuroscience Center in Morgantown, West Virginia, and he has pioneered a treatment that is commonly used now, according to the show, for Parkinson, and also they're working on drug addiction. And I wish you would interview Dr. Ollie Reese.
Madeline, thank you so much for that guest suggestion and for sharing that. And perhaps, you know, these medical developments on the horizon, Parkinson's disease and addiction. Dr. Ollie Reese, we got it down. Let's go to Carol now, joining us from Milwaukee. Carol, hi. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to hear about oligarchs and their hidden money, which the public doesn't know about, and they don't have to pay taxes on it. And sometimes they get it illegally from cities. Who knows what corruption goes on, even in the United States, now without much media coverage of city halls and things like that. So all sorts of money is put into, I understand, South Dakota, for example, and they have laws that keep us from knowing whose money it is, whether they're paying they're not paying taxes, and it's billions and billions, immense amounts of money.
And so tracing where this money is going, and specifically here in the United States?
It could be worldwide, because they could have gotten it from Russia and then put it in the United States, stolen it from the people of Russia or China also.
And Carol, have you been following this issue? Why do you see it?
I've read about it.
Yeah.
And it could explain a lot of what's going on here in the United States, because they have tremendous power with all that money. They're stronger than cities, or, you know, sometimes, because they have more money.
Okay, Carol, thank you so much. Tracing the money, hidden money in America and elsewhere, and the implications of that. Heard from Bill in Michigan, would like a show on forestry, the forest industry, and forest health. Bill, thank you so much for listening and for that suggestion. Jacob in Madison is joining in, would like to bring back a Mondays with Mike-like program. Jacob would like to invite the new WPR director, Sarah Ashworth, or another WPR representative, Jacob says, to come on the morning show, give updates on WPR, hear from listeners. And Jacob said this could be like a monthly update. Jacob, appreciate that as we explore what is on your mind. We're collecting future show ideas from you. We're rewinding on some memorable conversations along the way. But we want to know, what topics deserve more time and attention? What deserves more focused conversation here in Wisconsin, and what's on the table? So still time to bring your ideas to this caller-only program. That's 800-642-1234 to join in, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Ideas are flowing in with this caller-only program. Your suggestions for future segments, they are front and center. They're the topic of conversation. Let's go to Tony in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, what would you like to bring up?
Good morning. The fallacy that electric is the penultimate panacea to save the planet is the biggest scam perpetrated on the energy-consuming public.
So do you mean electric vehicles?
Everything. Heat pumps, air conditioning, heating, electric vehicles. 83% of the global electricity is generated by gas, oil, or coal. On the best day, electricity is only 26% efficient. So therefore, 84% of the input from generation to consumption is lost. Internal combustion engines are anywhere from 50 to 60% efficient.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, you've really done your research on this.
Kind of my field.
Okay.
When you look at BTU for BTU, foot pound for foot pound of torque, we think electricity is 100% efficient because there's no exhaust pipe. But 84% of the energy that was put into generating electricity is lost to the atmosphere and in generation. And not even to speak of the rare earth materials, my supposition is that electricity is putting more parts per million carbon in the atmosphere than high efficiency natural gas consuming appliances.
Tony, you bring a lot of food for thought to that. Thank you so much for that topic suggestion. Mike in New London now. Mike, hi.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is to have someone on, perhaps DNR or other wildlife specialists. What are the impacts of tournament fishing and use of technology? There's like a forward-facing sonar that if you're out on a lake with a boat, you point the boat places, it shows where the fish are. What is the impact of all this on the populations of game fish, for example, like walleyes and bass?
So the environmental implications, the effects on the larger ecosystem and these fish populations, is that what I'm hearing, Mike?
Exactly. The fish populations for the regular sport fishermen, say as myself, these tournament fishing where they go out, you know, in mass in all this technology, catch a bunch of fish, then they often let them go. But there's a, say, 30% roughly mortality of the ones they have to release them. But they're depleting the natural fish populations in these bodies of water.
Let me ask you this. Have you seen an increase in the number of tournaments over time?
Well, there certainly have been, but it's not. This is not based on data. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I mean, 20 years ago, they started, I guess, in my mind. And now it's, I guess, I consider it rampant. You just hear large motors and everybody racing off to their spot and impacting fishing for the regular.
For the rest of the people. Mike, thank you so much for the implications of sport, of tournament fishing in particular in Wisconsin as an idea for further conversation. Emma in Kenosha is here. Emma, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I'd like to hear more about like investments or personal finance for young people. So I'm in my 30s, and I've just started investing now, and I'd like to see more programming about how young people can easily invest and look to their future, because let's face it, to not be too pessimistic, how do we know if Social Security is going to be there for our future?
So do you look for information now as you enter the ability to make investments and know where to put your money?
Sure. So I've actually started talking to a local investment firm. They've broke it down really easy for me on how I can work with investing and brought up a couple of programs like Betterment and how I can utilize that platform to start personal financing on my own or investing on my own, excuse me.
Okay, so technology in the mix as well. Are you concerned about financial well-being in your later years? I mean, in the 30s, it is hard to think about what will happen in decades into the future.
Yeah, very much so. I don't want to rely on it. I've heard too much about, well, there's a potential it might not be there. There's a potential it could be there. I'd rather just have a nest egg set up and ready and rather get it started now because I can do small payments now and have a bigger output in the future.
Emma, thank you so much for calling in, for bringing that. Appreciate it. Brian in La Crosse is here. Brian, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am so tired of the way people drive. I wonder if it would be possible to get someone from the DMV or the State Patrol or a sheriff's department somewhere to tell people that it's not a suggestion as far as how you're supposed to merge onto a freeway. Doesn't matter if the traffic is moving 40 miles an hour or 80 miles an hour. You're supposed to match their speed and merge so you're not affecting them. The people that just this morning, somebody was almost stopped at the end of the on-ramp. I can't even imagine what they were thinking. It's dangerous.
Do you see reckless driving as well being a danger where you are in La Crosse?
Yeah, and that's mostly anymore attributable to people on their
distraction
on their cell phones. Mm-hmm. Actually, have had people that I know killed as a result of that.
Well, let me bring one thing up for you, that tomorrow we are discussing a proposal for automatic red light cameras and looking at research around these cameras at intersections and elsewhere and the effects of them. And so I want to make sure that you can know about that. That is a conversation tomorrow after 7 o'clock, as we look at that issue with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Of course, Brian, there is much more discussion about this issue around driving. Appreciate you calling in. Nancy in Milwaukee is next. Nancy, hi.
Hello. The Board of Regents for UW have had appropriated for them a very large sum of money, $300 million, that is going to be spent to build a very large sports complex under the supposition that scouts from major football teams need a place to come to Wisconsin to watch our football players play in the highest degree of comfort. This building will be the size of a football field, which they need to have in order to watch the complete game. So my feeling is that considering that WHADU has had many programs on the vast amount of homelessness across America, this is the height of hypocrisy for UW Regents to spend $300 million on a place where football players can play in the highest degree of ease and comfort. I think this matter should be brought to a Wisconsin referendum. I am very filled with hostility about a 9-person Board of Regents making a decision to spend $300 million on a sports building.
Nancy, I want to jump in there. We have it down looking at the expansion of the sports-related athletic infrastructure for the UW and vastly around Wisconsin as well, and how those dollars are spent and why. Nancy, thank you so much. Heard from Susanna, wrote in to suggest ageism, especially female-based, is one of the only socially acceptable discriminations to still persist and seemingly thrive. There are so many age stereotypes that need exposing, Susanna writes, and young people are seemingly unaware of many of these. You can't escape aging. Susanna, thank you for that suggestion to look more deeply at ageism. Gary in Ripon is here. Gary, hi.
Hi, Kate. In a previous segment, you expressed a contradiction when you mentioned sustainable growth. I would like to have somebody come on and talk about how it's not 1624 anymore, and here's how we're going to have not growth.
So not growing is what you're saying.
Yes.
Is there a particular organization, is there a particular expert who comes to mind for you that is can really, you know, bring this topic to a larger conversation?
Well, unfortunately, at this moment, I don't have a specific organization or person in mind. And I know we're kind of in a small minority, so I'm afraid I can't help you there.
Gary, thank you for calling in, though. Appreciate it. And looking at how Gary says sustainable growth, that is a contradiction. What about no growth? We heard from Greg and said they have a few suggestions. Greg would like to bring back the Week in Review to hear about events in Wisconsin. Greg would also like to hear from the Department of Health Services Secretary Designee Kirsten Johnson. Greg, thank you so much. Tom from Madison called, would like a program on insurance companies. And Tom says they got a letter saying their insurance rate is based on their credit score. And Tom says, that seems off. That seems not quite right. You're with us for a caller-only program as we gather up all of your interests for future segments this month and beyond. And we want to know what you think should be getting more time and attention in these times. What situations are you encountering? What do you want people to know? Drop us a line, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We invite your ideas for future segments on this caller-only program. And look, the ideas, they're endless on what would make a segment. And in recent days, we've talked about new voting maps, migrant worker protections, monarch butterflies, healthcare, robots. Do you listen for discussions on politics? Maybe it's health, education, advice, something else? Join in with your show ideas now at 800-642-1234. We're also looking out for your email of show topics to ideas@WPR.org. Heard from Vicky, who wrote in to say, just received a letter from U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin describing undocumented migrants as, quote, illegal aliens. And Vicky says Trump's dehumanizing rhetoric is spreading to members of Congress and believes this is targeted propaganda that slowly affects people's views and opinions. And Vicky wants to talk about that transition and the implications of that language. Vicky, thanks. This is a hard return here, a hard paragraph return. Andy would like a show on cuddle parties, which is a terrific national organization, Andy says, that provides consent training and explored safe, intentional, platonic touch in this world of further trends of alienation, singlehood, and loneliness. And Andy says, also a show on romanticism would be welcome and on asexuality. Andy, thanks. Let's go to Anne in Campbellsport. Anne, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to hear a program on Medicaid expansion in Wisconsin. I know the Republican legislators have been fighting that, even though the majority of Wisconsinites are in favor of it. So I'd like to know where that's at and the justification for not expanding it.
What about, Anne, the implications for expanding it? What effects it would have on the health of Wisconsinites? Would that also, do you imagine, be a part of the conversation?
Yes. Yes, I just think our health system is so broken. Any help we can get anywhere would be appreciated, and I think hearing about it would be beneficial to everyone.
Anne, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for calling in with that topic of looking more closely at Medicaid expansion and what it would mean for the health of Wisconsinites and beyond. Let's go to Jay in Stevens Point. Jay, hi.
Hi, this is G from Stevens
Point. Oh, G, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'd like to see a program that illuminates the fact that Wisconsin has the largest achievement gap in education between black and white students in the nation. And then along with the fact that our legislature right now sits on top of $4 billion that they could use to help with this kind of particular point of shame for our state. Thank you.
You feel the surplus should go toward trying to level this achievement gap and put it into education?
Well, part of it should. I think it's one of the most important things we do.
G, thank you so much for listening and calling in and looking more closely at the achievement gap and how to make progress on that for our students in Wisconsin. Christine lives in Pine City and has a logger in their woods. Christine wants to know, what are the laws associated with logging? And would love to know more about logging, the paper industry, and forestry at large in the state. Christine, thank you for that suggestion. Keith in Lake, Wisconsin called and said that they want a program on the economic impact of the universities of Wisconsin. Keith wants to know if it creates jobs, how much money do researchers generate for the state? So, Keith, thank you so much for that. Appreciate these comments flowing in. And as we hear what you want to talk about on the morning show, you can call in with your show ideas. As we take stock, we write them down. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy emailed the morning show and requested a program about food additives and health. And we're working to schedule a show about artificial colors and flavors, and that is for next Thursday, the 29th. And so, Randy, we really hope that you can tune in, and thank you so much for that suggestion. And now let's hear yours at 800-642-1234. Vern called in during a previous caller only, asked for more conversation about increasingly popular electric vehicles. And we talked about EVs with Jamie Page Deaton at Car Talk. Here's Deaton talking about plug-in hybrid vehicles.
What is great about these plug-in hybrids is when the electric power is depleted, then the gas engine kicks in. So you can go 30 miles with, you know, no emissions from your car directly. And then, you know, you've got this backup engine. So it really eliminates the need to stress over, you know, if I'm on this, will there be a charger? Will the charger be working? Because you've always got that gas station as kind of a backup. And this is a really great option for people who want to go electric, but aren't really ready yet. Or if they do, you know, a lot of driving into areas where the infrastructure isn't there yet, this allows you to kind of have your cake and eat it too. So if you're in the market for a new car and you're thinking electric, go check out a plug-in hybrid because it can effectively be a vehicle that's going to bridge the gap while infrastructure and, you know, charging times and battery tech gets sorted out.
That is Jamie Page Deaton at Car Talk. Let's go to Margo in Menominee. Margo, hi.
Hi, Kate. First, I want to say congratulations on really making a nice transition into your job over the year or two that you've been doing this. You've grown more comfortable, and it's just good waking up to you.
Oh, Margo, thank you for those kind words. Appreciate it.
Oh, okay. Second thing is Menominee Area School District had a referendum for funding that failed yesterday, and it failed pretty badly, 41% to 59%. There probably were some errors with how it was put together, but our area is going to have a lot of referenda going on, Eau Claire, Altoona, Chippewa Falls, and a lot of that is because of funding that the legislature changed about 10, 15 years ago. So our school district's funding needs to get tinkered with at the state level.
And you see a more deeper conversation about why these referendums are coming and what these school districts are asking for from voters?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And then I also want, you know, the state legislators to kind of be held to account for what's happening, because this was our first referendum in years and years, if ever, on just funding the school district, and it failed.
So what do we do now? Margo, thank you so much for bringing that. Appreciate it. And we have it down here on school referendums. Anna wrote in to say, just read that the solar industry is heading into trouble due to the solar loan products being packaged into asset-backed security packages sold to big Wall Street entities. And Anna and their spouse, they plan to buy a solar system for their home this year, but with solar equipment manufacturers being affected by the downward spiral of the industry, Anna has doubts about going forward. Will the equipment makers go bankrupt? No parts available? So Anna, thank you so much for bringing that development and looking more closely at the implications for solar. Wow, thank you for your contributions, your ideas. Keep them flowing to the morning show. We appreciate it. And don't forget, you can still visit our program page. Fill out a quick 2-question form to share more with us. You can find that at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.